Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Every day.
Here's John Williams.
Laboring away in the 18th story downtown studio. Our sky view is not too bad today, but Lord, the weather's going to change. You see what's going to happen out west? 50-degree temperature drops. It was 85 in Denver yesterday. It'll be below freezing tonight, and they're going to get snow. That's not going to come exactly our way, so enjoy this last really nice day and then more weather to come. This is John Williams. We're here weekdays till 3. The Mincing Rascals podcast will drop around 5 o'clock this evening. It's our award-winning roundtable discussion that Steve Bertrand didn't think was as good today as it should have been, but I'll let you be the judge of the Mincing Rascals. Can I just share a quick observation before we go to the meat on the bone today? I'm a guy that likes to voice to text. Lauren Lapp,
my mom
loves
to do that too. I don't because it's always wrong.
This is such a generational thing, and only recently was it pointed out to me. A person in their 20s said, people in their 50s do voice to text. You old people like that. I thought I was on the cutting edge of the technology because rather than pounding away with my thumbs, I'm talking into my phone and it's typing it out well enough for me. So I like voice to text. I said, how is it that that became sort of the place for old people? And you'd think young people would be the ones that embrace technology more, and they would be the big voice to texters. But it seems like it's, I don't know where the line is, 45 years old and more. They're the older people voice to text.
People that like to call on the phone.
Maybe that's it. I do think this. When you're voice to texting, it's more comprehensive. You're using a lot more words. And maybe the difference is young people don't want to take the time to issue a lot of words. They'll do some emojis. They'll do some abbreviated language. Their texts will be, you ever get a text from your parent? It's longer, isn't it? And it's because they're talking to you and they're using all of the syllables.
But then there's also a lot of errors, even to the point where I have no idea what they're trying to say to me.
So is that it? It's not to you that you don't want to make the effort to be so verbose. It's you're just afraid that it's going to get it wrong?
Yeah, well, with my experience, most of the time there are errors, and then I'm taking more time to fix the errors than I am or would have been just typing it out.
Well, it's funny you mention that because I'm looking at a text I sent to my son last night, and I used the word long shot, but instead it came out Kong shoddy.
See, how is that even more accurate? How would that be something in a sentence you wanted to say?
I said, so boy, that's a real Kong shoddy, eh? And then he went, huh? And then I went, Kong shoddy. Oh, that's a new word. I mean long shot. And then he went back, ha, ha, ha. So now we've got this whole sub-dialogue going on that's about Kong shoddy, which, by the way, I kind of like. I think I'm going to start using Kong shoddy now instead of long shot. But, okay, so that's not a perfect use of the technology. But there are so many times that voice to text is just so awesome. You can say so much, and it magically appears as the printed word on the screen.
I do like to use it with the Apple Watch, but that's about it.
Well, then the rest of the time you will type it out with your thumb or your fingers?
Yes, because I've become so well trained that my two little thumbs are so fast.
Don't you think you could do it quicker by voice to text?
No. Because I'm speaking so slow and accurately,
yes,
hoping that it gets it right.
That's my generation. They're talking into their phone. I will pick you up at 4:30.
And especially in public, it's just even a little bit more strange because it's like, well, now we all know.
I know. Well, listen, so this is the thing. Okay, so I like voice to text because of its simplicity. I don't like that I'm broadcasting, though, my message to anybody within range, right?
The doctor called. It's not good. There's so many ways it could go bad.
I completely understand. And yet I do it because I think I'm quicker with my words than my thumbs. Now, what I don't like about voice-activated technology is my smart speaker. So we're sitting there listening to some music. I'm not loving this song. Once upon a time, you could just go up and hit your CD changer and it would advance to the next track. But now you say, smart speaker, skip, which is a way of telling everybody in the room, I don't like this song, and I'm now going to control the music in the room, as opposed to, I can't just sit there and listen to 4 more minutes of Chet Baker. No, I've got to advance forward. And I hate the announcing every, turn it up, turn it down. You know, there's no silent action anymore. You have to announce to the room what we're doing. And I don't know, does that sound silly? But I hate that part of it.
No, it is. It is interesting because you're right, and it almost makes you feel silly.
Right. Wait, what? You can't take 4 more minutes of this jazz tune? What's the matter with you? Or I like it louder, you like it lower. Now it's this.
We've all become like Inspector Gadget. It's like go speaker, change the music.
I know. So I don't like that part of my whole audio system. But I do use that on my smart speaker, and it's just weird to me because I never would have guessed that using voice to text on your phone is sort of the province of the older folks, and the younger folks don't do it. I don't think I've ever seen my sons. I don't think I've seen producers Griffin, Ashley, or Elif voice to text, and yet they're on their phone all the time. You don't voice text. Bertrand's real old. Hey, Steve, are you listening to WGN Radio right now?
I am now, yeah.
Are you? do you use voice to text
no,
on your phone?
No, I don't.
Well, why not, Steve? It's an amazing piece of technology.
Because I haven't really figured it out yet. I just haven't bothered to, you know? Because then, well,
you
so
don't know
then you.
How?
Well, I'm sure I could figure it out. I've done it accidentally a few times. But then you have to proofread it anyway, right?
Yes and no.
So voice to texting is for people who are cheating and doing it in their car, basically.
Or are just saying too much, right? They're, you know, if you have to use voice to text and you're talking paragraphs into your phone, maybe you need to cut back the verbiage. Maybe that's it. It's 1:13. This is WGN. You can always call or text.
Or voice to text.
312-981-7200. I told Steve that I think there are some quirky things about Chicago. And I think on the one hand, we sort of embrace them. And we think, oh, that's the neat thing about this city. And then some of them, while we say that, we say, yeah, but that's not a good thing about our city. So I've got an example of one that was in the news today. And I think it is so Chicago, and it is so wrong. I need you to tell me what you think about it after this. Okay, quirky Chicago, dibs. Great Chicago tradition, kind of quirky, it's us. Hot dogs and our fascination with or allegiance to the way a hot dog has to be prepared. Fussing over the names of buildings. Cops cheating by parking illegally at games, but they don't get tickets. That's upsetting to some people more than others. But the way we do our elections and sometimes run sham candidates is seen as maybe not unique to Chicago.
You're so cute.
But it is a very Chicago thing. And people go, oh, you're so cute, John. You really fuss about that. Hey, that's just the way we do it. That's Chicago.
Welcome to Chicago, my friend.
I know. Unless you
stalking
are
horse.
David Kropa. Okay, there's a story in the Tribune today by Ray Long and Gregory Pratt. And it's about that ongoing saga of a young man that's been on our show before. His attorney has, too. The young man is David Krupa, K-R-U-P-A. He's a DePaul student who ran for city council against Alderman Marty Quinn. Marty Quinn always runs unopposed. He has never faced another name next to his on the ballot. Think about that until this time. And no one knew who Krupa is. He's a 19-year-old student whose parents and grandparents helped him gather the signatures to take on the mighty Quinn. Alderman Quinn is Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan's guy. So you've got Mike Madigan and Quinn. You've got every ounce of power and money in the world for Quinn to not only run, but usually run unopposed. Now, you need signatures to run, equaling 4% of the votes cast in the previous election. So if 1,000 people voted last time in your ward, then you need 40 signatures. Currently, for most of the wards, you'll need 300 to 600 signatures. Depends on where you live and how many people voted last time. But on average, you need 300 to 600. Krupa turned in 1,729. 1,700 people signed up for him. So Team Madigan Quinn sends their operatives out over the phone and door to door. They went into the neighborhoods. They're on the southwest side. And they asked people if they had signed up for young Krupa's petition. Did you sign on his petition? And would you like to rescind that endorsement? Chicago election law allows them to turn those names in and cancel them out. If you said, yeah, I changed my mind, now you sign a new signature, and then the one cancels the other one out. So now you no longer endorse him. And if you get enough people to do that, then he doesn't meet the threshold, he's off the ballot. So now you're subtracting from him, but you've got to go door to door and find those people. People on the southwest side say that they were bombarded with daily calls and door knocks. They didn't know, but they would ask. They just went door to door canvassing the neighborhood. And sometimes the operatives were red in the face screaming at these people to take their name off of the Krupa signature and put it on this one. Citizens there were worried that if they didn't take their names down off of the Krupa ballot, you know, off the Krupa sheet, that they wouldn't get city services. They'd be in trouble. Eventually, the Quinn people got 2,800 signatures saying we changed our minds. We don't want the DePaul kid on the ballot. 2,800 people. Now think about that, because the kid only turned in 1,800 signatures to start. The kid turned in 1,800 signatures, and Marty Quinn's people got 2,800 people to say, I changed my mind, take them off. On top of that, only 187 of the 200 of the 2,800 names, only 187 of the 2,800 names that Quinn got, in fact, endorsed Krupa to begin with. It means that maybe 2,600 people that Quinn turned in were either liars or fake names. You don't have to pay attention to all of that math, but I think it's pretty compelling when the kid says, okay, here's my 1,800 signatures, and his opponent says, well, 2,800 of them are wrong. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago is now looking into this. Krupa has filed a civil suit against Quinn and Madigan. He's charging fraud. He says, look, people were forced into perjury or making false statements. Just before the election, Krupa's attorneys were set to subpoena Mike Madigan and this Quinn guy, Marty Quinn, and force them to testify. You know, okay, what are you guys doing? How are you doing it? What's going on here? So the Quinn people said, okay, we'll drop it. We won't challenge the signatures. So Krupa, the 19-year-old DePaul kid's name, did appear on the ballot against Marty Quinn, and Quinn won with 86% of the vote. Because that's the way quirky, fun elections happen in Chicago. But isn't that just an amazing story? And isn't that kind of sad when you look around and go, oh, how are things the way they are in Chicago or Illinois? That's how the way things are in Chicago or Illinois. This Quinn guy runs without a name against him. And the one time an unknown 19-year-old surfaces to say, well, I'd like to play the civic game, I'll run for office, they crush him like bug. They say Mike Madigan doesn't just win, he crushes opponents. Why would he care to work that hard going door to door to find, literally think about that, knock on somebody's door. Hey, did you sign that kid's petition? No. Okay, thank you. Next door. Did you find that kid's petition? Yes, you did. Now I'm going to keep coming back and calling you and calling you until you cave on that endorsement. That's a lot of work, and you don't even need to do it. Okay, let's pick up a couple of phone lines. We'll start with the attorney, Michael Dorff. Hey, Michael, it's John. You're on WGN. How are you?
Fine, John. Thanks for having me.
Michael, your name is in the story, and I see that David Krupa is that him on the phone line? Okay, so we could include him in this conversation, too, if you don't mind, Michael.
But of course.
You are representing David then, right?
Right, to get him on the ballot.
Is that version of the story that I told correct?
There's a little difference in some of the numbers, but basically it's correct, and you draw a really nice line, because there's some cases of election fraud that are hard to explain, but as you pointed out, they submitted 2,796 affidavits of people who swore under oath that they had signed David's petitions and then were revoking it, but we only had collected 1,729 signatures. And the thing about it is, these affidavits to revoke signatures have to be filed before we file our petitions.
Right.
So they had no idea who had signed our petition at that time, and they didn't knock and say, "Did you sign David's petition?" They just knocked and said, "Sign this affidavit."
Oh, really? That should be against the law.
Well, yeah, we asked in our case in front of the Chicago Board of Election Commissioners. We said this is clearly there's perjury. There's also subornation of perjury by the Quinn people who are requesting people to perjure themselves, and that's why we asked for a referral to the state's attorney. And not only did the Board of Elections refer it to the state's attorney, they also referred it to the U.S. attorney.
So that's where it is right now. I mean, maybe we haven't heard the last of this, right?
Yeah, I think some investigations are still going on.
That young man, David Krupa, is on the other phone line. Hi, David. It's John. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me back.
I'm going to vote for you anytime, any way, anywhere, just because of you.
Thank you.
How old are you now? What are you doing, David?
Well, I'll be turning 20 later this month, and you know, I'm working, going to school, helping people get on the ballot in different parts of the city and around the county. So,
what are you studying at DePaul?
I'm studying political science and economics. I'm double majoring.
Imagine that. And why were you running for alderman?
Well, I noticed that we hadn't had somebody challenge the incumbent in my ward in 30 years, and I thought it was, you know, undemocratic to have only one person on the ballot all the time. And there were a lot of people in my ward who weren't really happy with the way things are going. And so I decided to provide another option. And I knew it would be hard, but I didn't know it would be that hard.
Yeah, so, I would feel like, you know, I'm looking at, I don't live in that ward. I'm on the outside looking in. But I think anytime somebody wants to throw their ring in the hat, I'm such a Pollyanna about this, but then we should all embrace the process, best man win, that sort of thing. They don't even want anybody else's name on the ballot. They don't want the citizens to have a choice.
No. No, no choices at all. I was actually talking to a couple of residents, and, you know, some of them described it as the 13th Ward is like communist Russia, where you only have one choice on the ballot,
yeah,
but you're still expected to go there and fill in that bubble.
Yeah.
For that one choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you don't vote, you don't get city services and things like that. It's ridiculous.
Gentlemen, so that's the criminal case, I guess, in the case of the U.S. attorney or state's attorney. But is there a civil case? Do you have any compensation due to you as a result of all of this?
Well, I have a pending federal civil lawsuit against Mike Madigan, 13th Ward Democratic Organization, Marty Quinn, and his PAC. It's not really for much, you know, money-wise, but it would set a good legal precedent saying that you can't do the things that they did,
yeah,
and you can't harass and intimidate the voters like they did. Like this article, you know, says that these are compelling stories. These are firsthand accounts of what happened.
And yeah.
I had been saying that this is what people were telling me, but, you know, and most people believe me, but, like, now it's proven because people came out and said it themselves.
God bless those people. It's in the Tribune. I didn't go into those details. But, yeah, there's a couple pages of people just saying, here's what happened to me. Here's how intimidated I was. But let me just address this to your attorney, Michael. I don't know what's right, but it seems to me like this would get the next heavy-handed politician's attention, $1 million. I think David should get $1 million in compensation. How about that? What do you think of that?
Well, I'm not involved in David's civil rights suit.
You're a lawyer. What do you think of my idea?
I think that there should be some penalty for doing something like this, and I would hope that the penalty comes from the state's attorney and the U.S. attorney's office. We're having enough problems today with making sure we have free and fair elections and people trying to delegitimize elections, and it's bad enough coming from Russia. It should not be coming from the 13th Ward.
Yeah. Well, that's such a good point, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, let's just have a free and fair election. And when they go out, imagine what they would do if if David Krupa was a household name, if he was a popular political figure and had resources, right? Who knows what sort of efforts they would take to undermine each other, right?
Yeah, probably increasingly illegal.
Well, all right, fellas, I'm out of time for this segment today, but I'd sure like to continue to follow this, at least on the criminal side, which means maybe we don't talk to you again, Michael, but I sure appreciate your efforts. And David, let's you and I stay in touch, too, and good luck to you on all of this.
Well, thank you very much. We will stay in
touch. Thank you, John. I appreciate
it. All right, gentlemen. David Krupa and Michael Dorf, his attorney. At least Dorf was for a while, but that's the way we do things in Chicago. And when I get to be king, it's not going to be that way. Whenever I go to Target or Home Depot, it seems to me the jewel, there's usually handicapped spots available up front. Some people may abuse it, but if you are a person, boy, I'm going to get it now.
No, I'll take the heat off you. Go ahead with what I say next. Go ahead.
If you are if you're a person with a handicap tag, I'll bet you very, very, very rarely are denied a space up front. Steve Bertrand, go.
I think there are too many handicapped spots.
Oh, I love the colors, yellow and green. Yeah, I wouldn't have said that. When they talk about things,
let's talk about things. I think this is your favorite part of the show, where you just repeat things on...
They're called highlights, Steve. We replay back parts of previous programs people may have missed, and we let them enjoy them again.
Generally, I'm the victim here, though.
Words came out of your mouth. No one had a gun to your head, as I recall that day.
Felt like I lived in the 13th Ward.
Are you as outraged as I am about how they do things in the elections around here? No.
Well, no, I'm not as outraged as you are, but that's pretty seems to be a pretty outrageous case.
Yeah. Krupa, K-R-U-P-A, vote for him in the next election. Can I even say that? He's not a candidate for anything. I'm going to write his name in for dog catcher. There's a young 19-year-old student. I mean, he's doing everything you want him to do. Go get yourself an education, kid, and be part of the process. Make the world better. He says, okay, I'll run against Marty Quinn. By golly, he doesn't even have an opponent. For 30 years, he's run unopposed. Huh, that sounds wrong. I'm going to put my foot forward. And the machine crushes him like bug. They just crush him. They break his soul. I don't know why I use a Russian accent there. By the way, that was a Russian accent. So I'm like on that kid's side. I mean, I just hate to see that go that way. I'm also, maybe this is the converse of that, not as exercised by the cops parking illegally at Cubs games and Bears games, or if they have to go to City Hall or something, they just park wherever. They put a little thing around their rearview mirror, or a placard on their dashboard, and it's a city cop, and the other cops know it, and then they don't give them a ticket. Well, wouldn't it be nice if you could go to a Bears game and you could just pretty much park anywhere you wanted? And when I think we've all seen versions of that, and I've always just kind of shrugged and go, well, that's what cops get to do. I didn't even think about the legality of that. I say, yeah, that's cops. Cops get to park places because maybe they'll be needed to do cop stuff or you know, on duty or otherwise. And generally speaking, I'm all for more cops being around my stuff and just making my world safer. So when I brought that up on the Mincing Rascals podcast that we recorded, I told everybody how nonplussed I am about this. On a scale of 1 to 10, I said I'm about a 2 on that. Outrage filled the room. Did I hear Ro Khan talk about this today? Were you listening in on that show yesterday, Lauren Lapka? Because I know you were busy wearing two hats yesterday. But I thought I heard Ro talking a little bit about this issue as well.
And it's hard for me to fully remember. Like you said, I was a little busy. But, you know, that sounds like something he would definitely go off about. Sound the alarms!
So I'm not out of place about that one. The other kind of national controversy that's got me a little surprised today is the Ellen thing, right? People are picking sides on that still. And it's not just because Ellen is a friend of George Bush and they were at the game and they were mugging together and then she did a monologue about that, but people are kind of taking sides on how she's been handling that. Why is this a thing? She went to the Cowboys-Packers game the other day. I don't know how it happened, but she's friends of the Bushes. I guess if you're Ellen, you get to be friends of the Bushes. Do you know how much money Ellen made in 2018? How much money would you guess Ellen DeGeneres earned in 2018.
In dollars?
Yes. Oh, you make joke.
I'm going to say, come on, Boris. I'm going to say $172
million. Yeah, $87
million.
Oh, well, that makes her the 15th highest paid celebrity in the world.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to be smart there. I didn't know, but...
Yeah, I mean, but $87 million. I know she's great, funny, TV show. I didn't know she was getting 80... She's not a movie star. I didn't know she was getting $87 million.
Well, she was in Finding Dory and Finding Nemo.
I'll bet checks are still coming in for those now that you mentioned it. I don't know what residuals are like, but she's a big name and those movies did well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Disney Pixar pays off pretty well.
So maybe that's part of it. I had props to you, lady. But it's funny because she's so self-effacing. She's such a nice lady. You don't think of her as some sort of mega millionaire who sometimes makes jokes about how rich she is or sitting up in the owner's suite at the Cowboys game next to a former president who, by the way, is about as opposite as her on a lot of social issues. And she said, well, part of her monologue yesterday was this.
But during the game, they showed a shot of George and me laughing together. And so people were upset. They thought, why is a gay Hollywood liberal sitting next to a conservative Republican president? Didn't even notice I'm holding the brand new iPhone 11. And but a lot of people were mad, and they did what people do when they're mad. They tweet. But here's one tweet that I loved. This person says, Ellen and George Bush together makes me have faith in America again. And here's the thing. I'm friends with George Bush. In fact, I'm friends with a lot of people who don't share the same beliefs that I have. We're all different, and I think that we've forgotten that that's okay that we're all different. For instance, I wish people wouldn't wear fur. I don't like it, but I'm friends with people who wear fur. And I'm friends with people who are furry, as a matter of fact. I have... friends who should tweeze more. But just because I don't agree with someone on everything doesn't mean that I'm not going to be friends with them. When I say be kind to one another, I don't mean only the people that think the same way that you do. I mean be kind to everyone. Doesn't matter.
So how can you not applaud at that, right? I mean, that was my take on that. But I was just a little surprised at her sort of equivocation there, or equivalencies. She says that... there are some people who are pro-fur and I'm against fur. I would imagine you and I could disagree about climate change but still be friends. But to me, there's something different about taking a stand on LGBTQ issues or gay rights generally. Should a person be able to marry another person of the same sex? If you don't think so, that's because maybe you think that it's sinful. You are looking at that person and saying, my view of you is that you are inherently sinful, that your core being is against God's will. That's a lot different than I wish you wouldn't wear fur. To me, that's even different than climate change, which I think is the most important issue on Earth.
Well, and the other thing...
I don't know how she's able to do that.
The other thing is that he and Karl Rove used gay marriage as a wedge issue for him to win re-election. I think it was re-election in 2004. I mean, they put up gay marriage amendments on state ballots to drive the vote, you know, to get people out there to vote. You feel strongly about gay marriage, you're going to go vote anyway, so then you'll probably vote for George Bush, and, you know, he won the election.
Yeah.
So now you're saying you don't think she should have sat next to him?
I'm saying that I'm surprised that she could be, well, I think I'm a pretty forgiving person. I think we should all try and find that muscle and flex it more. But I just don't think it's the same as...
people who wear fur, yeah.
You know, pick the issue, the economy, education, immigration, right? What divides us the most? I understand how we can be divided on those things, but yet we should still all try and go to Thanksgiving together. But I don't know how you sit next to a person who said, I fundamentally disagree with your almost existence as a person.
Your soul.
Yeah, that's it. It's not an issue. It's you. We don't disagree on furs. I disagree about the way you live your life and who you are at your core.
But don't you think that's also the best way to convince someone to see you differently?
Okay,
by showing that you're a good person.
Okay, so maybe, and she doesn't need to have an agenda, but that would be the silver lining of this, Lauren Lapka. So then, if Ellen is as generous about this as she is, and yet I'm still going to enjoy his company, maybe eventually that changes George Bush's heart, or the hearts of people that find that sinful. You know, if that's her agenda, maybe that's what she's doing. Or maybe that'll just happen because of that.
Well, I'll go a step further. I don't think she probably needs to change George Bush's heart. I think he probably, you know, is fine with it all along. He just used it to win an election.
Okay.
Right? Well, I mean, we know Laura, we know Barbara were much more gay-friendly publicly than he was. And
I think the Cheneys had a little bit of a turn of heart on that eventually.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, yeah. Lord knows they have a gay daughter. Wouldn't that change your views about that a little bit?
I'm not sure if it's been uniform in the Cheney family, but...
I haven't asked either of them, but it would just seem to me like that would challenge some of my belief systems if my kid said, Mom, Dad, I need to tell you something. Oh, really? Okay, well, I find you to be a good person, and I raised you, and we're all good, God-fearing, tax-paying Christians here, so maybe I need to re-examine my views. How can you not do that? But so Ellen, you know, says that, and now celebrities are taking sides, and you know, everybody seems to be taking issue with the way she handled it. Maybe she should not have been so accommodating to George Bush. And that's not exactly how I'm splitting this hair. I'm surprised that she's able to do that because it's not an issue. It's your essence. But I sure like the message of let's all be as forgiving as we can.
Okay, so since we're being cynical, and couldn't we also say that this very public hug on her show works very well for Ellen's image? And that she might be furthering her own brand by doing that?
Well, that's what somebody else pointed out to me, Steve. And in fact, then I went back and found the December 12th, 2018 New York Times article by Jason Zinnemann that is titled, Ellen DeGeneres is not as nice as you think.
Right.
Ellen DeGeneres is not as nice as you think. And there's 8 pages, if you print them, about what a nice lady she's not. She is evidently one of these don't look me in the eyes people. She's one of these people that yells at underlings and stuff like that. Amy Klobuchar, the sweet senator from Minnesota, has a bit of an image like that. I don't know if it's true or not, but she's been labeled with some of that as well. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know how that is. I don't know how truthful that is. But that's another thing that people are taking issue with. It's not the hypocrisy, if you will, of Ellen reaching across the divide, but it's the fact that she's even that message itself may not necessarily be something she always practices, even if she preaches it. She's not always a nice person. And I don't want to know that. I don't think I need to know that. I don't work for her. I'm not backstage. She said we should be nice to everyone, not just people we agree with. That's a lovely sentiment.
Yeah, right. I totally agree with her. But, and there's always a but I wish she... I don't know. I think it's okay to disagree with people, though, right?
Well, that's it. But you don't have to be friends with George Bush. So, like, you could say, I'm going to be nice to everybody, but I can't be your best friend looking at selfies on our phone at a football game in the owner's suite because there's something fraudulent about this friendship.
Or maybe I could say, look, I can be friends with him, but I totally disagreed with the way he treated this issue in 2004.
No, I think you can be. Let's all be as nice to everybody as we can be. And if I was at an event with you, I would be as nice to you as I can be. But I don't think we are friends if sitting next to me, you actually disagree with who I am fundamentally. You can't be friends then. You're not friends. Okay, that's a couple of thoughts on that. You may care to chime in. Oh, look at all the phone lines are ringing. 312-981-7200. You can call or text WGN. Let's talk to John. You're on WGN. John, thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
Hey, how you doing? George Bush being a Republican, at one time governor of Texas, but I lived there at least. I used to live in Texas. And Ellen DeGeneres, I think what you're failing to realize is that there are levels in society, and this is my observation because I've worked on fundraisers and other things when during my time in Texas. The people at the top, the elite, or the 1%, whatever you want to call them, their lives are completely intertwined with people who are interior designers and hairstylists and fashion designers, all of whom, or many of whom, I should say, are gay, openly gay, and there's no issue. I think that, you know, when Rove and Bush and Cheney took stands against gay marriage or whatever, that was strictly a political, in my opinion, a political move. And I don't think it reflects their personal opinions. And I think there's a message sent down for the voting, segment of the population, and maybe even the chattel and the lowest common denominator.
Did you just say chattel? Yeah,
that's
go ahead.
Who it's appealing to.
Well, so when you watch Ellen and George Bush, you think that can happen. That can actually be a warm.
Well, under your scenario, does that make it better or worse?
In my scenario, it doesn't change it one way or the other. I mean, I've been to parties where celebrities and oilmen, by the way, had their trophy wives on their elbow. But that's another story. It doesn't. It's a non-issue, as far as I can tell. My opinion.
Well, it seems to me like they're using, listen, I'm happy to be nice to these gay people you described, as long as they're doing my hair and nails, but if I had to vote, I would vote to deny them some of the rights that I get, that me and my trophy wife get. And I don't understand how the gay person in that scenario, boy, we're painting with broad brush strokes here, but I'm doing it. I don't know how those people are able to put up with that. I don't know why an Ellen, if you will, is so tolerant of that.
I don't know. I mean, I've just made observations, and that's one of them that I noticed when I was doing my time in Texas, is that there was a different, dynamic or paradigm among certain segments of that, population.
And they didn't even think about it. It didn't even cross their minds. So they're all getting along, and we're interacting with each other, and it doesn't even matter to them on a day-to-day level, is what you're saying, right, John?
That's what I think, and especially, and you are right, broad strokes and stereotypical observations, but, stereotypes exist for some reason.
No, I get it. By the way, you're from Texas. How long have you lived in Illinois? How long have you lived in Illinois?
I don't live in Illinois. I live in Wisconsin. But I lived in Texas for all of the 1990s. I got there in 89 and left in 2000.
Well, I appreciate you listening to us in Wisconsin. Thank you for the call, John. I'm glad you're joining us. Let's talk to Mary. You're on WGN. Mary, what'd you want to say?
Oh, as soon as I saw that, I watch Ellen all the time, and she has changed over the years. She's very political now, and she makes it crystal clear that she has no use for Donald Trump, and she doesn't even joke sometimes about it. I mean, she's had people on like, wouldn't you even have him on if you had on all the other presidents? And she's like, absolutely not. So I'm thinking it's a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, because I know the Bushes, even though they're Republicans.
Oh, that's interesting.
They made it clear, well, what happened with Jeb Bush? And then Trump barely got to go to the funeral. But her priority right now is her disdain for Donald Trump. If you watched Ellen, you would know.
I did not. I appreciate the call. Thank you, Mary. Steve, your turn. You're on WGN. What do you want to say?
Hey, John. It makes me laugh, because if you remember when George Bush was president, they used to say that George Bush does not like black people. And then George Bush became friends with Michelle Obama.
Well,
and people on the other side were like, how can you be friends with Michelle Obama? So it's like you can't please everybody. I think that Ellen and George Bush being friends is just normal. I think if you're sitting next to somebody at a football game, are you supposed to show disdain for them? Are you supposed to not like them because you're of different sides? That doesn't make sense. I think that you can be mature adults, have a disagreement. I think that's what's wrong with the country now, is that we can't disagree with somebody. You either hate or you're not like somebody else. You can't like the same things. You have to pick a side, and that's not the way we should be. Growing up in Chicago, I used to get that a lot when I was a Cubs fan growing up on the South Side. You have to be a Sox fan. You grew up on the South Side. I'm a Cubs fan because that's what I like. I shouldn't have to choose. I have that right to choose who I want to support. So I just think that we're at this point in life where it's too difficult to please everybody.
I'm really glad you're listening and called too. Perry, you're on WGN. What do you want to say?
Hi, John. I guess my thoughts on this are that want to comment about the thought that Ellen's sitting next to George Bush. She's sitting next to somebody that is against her as a person. And I think that's painting this with too big of a broad stroke, as somebody said earlier. What I'm hoping is that she can see in him that they just disagree on this one point. And what she's seeing is the other qualities of George Bush that are good, and likewise with George, with Ellen.
Yeah.
So in other words, her being an advocate of gay marriage, her being LGBT, is not the entire definition of Ellen as a person. There's more to Ellen as a person than just that. So that's why I think it's not quite as black and white as I'm sitting next to somebody who hates me or doesn't like me as in my soul, whatever you were saying earlier. So
yeah.
That's pretty much it.
We got some good calls today, Perry, and you're one of them. Thanks for joining us. I'm sure we could all agree that one of the great moments was when George Bush handed the cough drop to Michelle Obama. Was it a wedding or a funeral? But that moment in the church where he hands her the cough drop.
I believe that was McCain's funeral.
Was it McCain's funeral? And you just thought, oh, yeah, that's a, kind of a perfect image for that scene in this country right now. Into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We got the news coming up.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Got another one.
Here's John Williams.
Voice to text snafu. Hi, it's John. I'll get to that in a second. It's 2:06. We're in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. We're here weekdays on this little program of mine from 1 to 3. Saturdays, 10 to noon. The Mincing Rascals is our award-winning podcast featuring Steve Bertrand and Eric Zorn and a cast of really smart people. And we sit around and talk about stories in the news. We recorded another Mincing Rascals podcast about an hour ago, 2 hours ago, and we'll drop that on you about 5 o'clock this evening. I hope you listen to the Mincing Rascals podcast. You know, we were talking about voice to text and how sometimes that doesn't work out exactly right. And somebody said to me in a text just a little bit ago, you can text to 312-981-7200. John, about 20 years ago, I used to be anti-gay. A-U-N-T-I-E. Anti-gay. I think they meant A-N-T-I, but voice to text didn't know that. Capital letters, anti-gay. Because I didn't understand people who were gay. The only way I came around, says 936, is because gay people sat with me and talked to me and helped me understand who they were and what they were, and that's how my opinions changed. So sitting with someone with a different opinion is the only way to get them to even think about your version. We were talking about George Bush and Ellen DeGeneres at that football game. Some of you are rolling your eyes. You can't believe America's talking about these two people sitting at a football game. But in the long run, they were doing more than that, right? 920 said, John, I thought Ellen was brilliant. I posted her response on my Facebook page. It's been removed now. Why? I'm thinking big thoughts. 847 said, maybe he changed his mind. I'm not sure what they mean by that. But, oh, yeah, George Bush changed his mind over the years. I don't know where his head or heart is on that right now. And finally, 331 said, hey, John, bottom line, kindness doesn't cost a thing. Love your show. Thank you for that text, Randy. Thank you all. Did you hear one Walter Jacobson, the legendary newsman on Steve Cochran's show today, opining about sports and paying college athletes? Hi, Walter Jacobson. How are you?
I'm fine, John. Very fine.
You put in long days at this radio station of ours, sir. You really craft your message over the week.
Well, it takes a lot of work to come up with an explanation of ideas. You have to be careful in our business, and I don't like to make mistakes. So, sure, I work hard at it, but I don't have to do my God as much as you do. I can't imagine the work that you do. You talk, every time I've been in here, you say something nice about how much I work, and I stand outside your office and see you in there never stopping. And today actually was kind of easy.
What, today for you?
Yeah, kind of easy today.
Well, you had your item already written and recorded.
Yeah. Oh, no. Aside from that, the subject is a little easier for me than usual, too.
Well, because why? Because you take in, it's easy for you to come to the conclusion you did about paying athletes?
I have been having that opinion for I don't know how long, since the beginning of the debates began. And I've always been strongly in favor of these athletes getting a fairer share of the money that is made in sports, which, of course, is in a massive, massive, colossal amount of money, and they don't get a penny out of it.
So you said today California passed, and Illinois is considering a law to require colleges to assure payments to their all-star athletes who are earning for their colleges, the NCAA, $14 billion? dollars a year?
A year. That's what the experts say. It's always a good idea to challenge the experts, but that's what they're saying. And it is true for sure. It is true without a doubt that they are making huge amounts of money, the NCAA, the colleges, and that money that they make, they split up with the coaches. You know, some of these coaches are making over $4 or $5 million a year on the goodwill and the talent and the skills of the players who get zilch.
I saw a map the other day, and it had all 50 states. And in each state, instead of saying Illinois or Michigan, it put the job of the highest paid public official in that state. Think about that. So in Ohio, it said football coach.
Oh, no. Really?
And in Illinois, it said it was either football or basketball coach. And I would say of the 50 states, 45 of them were either football coach or basketball coach. The other ones would have been the head of a public hospital, like a university hospital, maybe University of Minnesota's. So the University of Minnesota Hospital CEO,
right,
is technically a publicly paid person, and that person might make $1 million a year or something. But without fail, it was almost always.
I thought I heard you say public officials.
Public officials.
And I was wondering how J.B. Prisker didn't get onto your list.
Because the
he doesn't earn it.
The public isn't paying him $1 billion.
Right.
He's worth that. But I think the governor's salary is a few hundred thousand.
Yeah, that's all.
The basketball coach makes that in a month.
But the public's not paying the basketball coaches, are they?
Yeah, I don't think they are. I think how they justify this is that they'll say, okay, if we want to get the best basketball or football coach, and that's going to cost $6 million, the boosters, you know, the private sector, the fans will chip in, or companies will chip in, and we'll pay that coach from a pool of money.
How sure are you of that?
I'll finish this and then give you my estimated probability. Separate from tuition, for instance. So tuitions do not go to high-paid basketball and football coaches.
Right.
80% estimated probability of accuracy.
Okay, I just remember one story about the head coach at UConn at one point was the highest-paid government worker in the state.
Yeah.
So, which would imply that his money was coming
from the state. Yeah, right. So I guess maybe that's the distinction I'm making, is it's tuition.
Right.
That's the students' money. But is it the taxpayer dollars?
You could make that tangential argument, because we pay our money into the state, and then the state decides what percentage of that money goes to the schools.
Okay, but I've taken us all down a road we don't need to go, because your point is not that. Your point is the student-athletes should get some of the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. And that's not public money. That's not state support of education. That's money that comes from the advertising community and from the schools themselves, where they get money aside from their
ticket sales, sodas, sweatshirts, T-shirts, stuff like that.
Well, but now the NCAA has a rule that says you can't put the name of an athlete on the back of his jersey, but it's okay to put the number on the back of his jersey. You can't pay the kids who are working hard to be good sports players and bring the schools a huge amount of money, but you don't worry about the coaches being given that money. But there's so many hypocrisies. There's so many contrary arguments that just don't make sense now, to me anyway.
Well, if we had to start somewhere, I would, and this is where they are going to start on this, right? If nothing else, jersey sales with the student's number and name on it, then the student is going to get, at least in California, right, some of that money. I wonder how much money they should get.
Well, the hard part is that's one of the hard parts. The other hard part is how to make this work. Which students, what are you going to do, judge their talents in basketball, football, and those who have a little better talent, bigger talent, get a little more money? It's going to be difficult. But, you know, they're making steps for progress. It's an equality issue. It's very important to give them a chance. You know, these kids, they work sometimes 30 to 40 hours a week training for the sport. And, you know, they're the NAACP and the colleges are I'm sorry saying NAACP. Guess that's on my mind a lot. The NCAA and the colleges are saying that the kids are getting scholarships.
What do you say to that?
Well, the scholarships are nothing compared to what they could be getting from the advertisers, for God's sakes. And there's no way to add up what they're getting to reach the amount of money that the schools are getting from March Madness and from the Rose Bowl and the Sugar Bowl and the Cotton Bowl. All that money goes to the NCAA and to the schools, and then they do with it what they want, and what they do is spend millions of it on the coaches. No.
The larger the numbers have been getting over the years, the more I've come around to your view on it.
Yeah. Really?
You know, I mean, because there's just so much money available, and it's such a big deal. And the students, the student athletes are really earning a lot of that money for the school through March Madness or a bowl game or whatever.
No
you
question.
So want that kid, that quarterback, to have a good season or a good game. So we'll get into this, say, into a bowl game that'll get us a lot of money. It's up to these kids. And the money is so large now that... Yeah, I don't know that I felt this strongly about this in the past, but it's like, give the kid a little of it. Come on.
You know, some of the math that's been done indicate that the average scholarship is, say, just pick a number, about $20,000 a year, including all the perks that go with the scholarship. And the revenue that comes into the schools from March Madness and the football games, bowl games, that money adds up to $70,000. So there's a huge disparity. And that's the main issue. Be fair to both sides. You know, the kids deserve a piece of the pie. The Madness, March Madness money, that's the biggest of all that comes into these schools.
Yeah. Well, that was your commentary earlier today.
Nick Saban, you know, the coach of the Alabama Crimson, you know, he's being paid, I said, $9 million. Since then, I think it's now $11 million a year. Maybe they should give Nady that.
Well, if that would make the team better, I'd be all for that. Yeah, I don't know what the cap is for how much a really successful coach should get.
Well, there are 10 states that are working on following the lead of California for the Fair Pay to Play Act. Kind of an appropriate name. I like that. And Illinois is one of them. So that's being discussed by the members of the General Assembly, and the chances are pretty good, better than just pretty good, that we will have that kind of law too. It will raise a lot of hell in the professional sports world, and those who believe, of course, that the kids don't need it because they get the scholarships, which is the falsest of all the arguments, as far as I'm concerned.
So is the thought that if I'm paying the student athlete, maybe they'll be less inclined to run off to the NBA or the NFL so quickly because they will get some money in college?
You know, not only that, but they cannot because of the regulations on minimum age. But in the NFL and the NBA, they can't go right from high school where they've been great players right into the National League and into the professional sports leagues because the rules of those leagues say you can't.
If you listened to Steve Cochran earlier this morning, you heard Walter Jacobson say there's $14 billion at play here and the students ought to be able to get some of it.
I still agree.
and I, here it is, 2:18 in the afternoon, and he still feels that way.
Right.
That's convictions, ladies and gentlemen. All right, it's good to see you, Walter. Always well-written, and it's always good to hear you on the radio.
Always great for me to have you to have me in. Thank you.
You betcha. It's 2:18 on GN. Fall is a lovely time of year, but it's hard to enjoy with chronic shoulder pain. And since this is the Joint Relief Institute, call them for elbow and knee pain, too. Whatever the joint is, here's the number, 708-888-0000. You can visit them online, jointreliefinstitute.com, or call that number, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. On the Mincing Rascals, this is a coincidence to me, but the other day we were talking about, and I think we did on this radio show of ours, too, the State of Illinois building, the Thompson Center. It's kind of an ugly building downtown. I was there yesterday to get my vehicle sticker renewed, and it was a model of efficiency. The people behind the glass could not have been less interested in talking to me, but they were very good about taking my money and giving me my sticker, and I was out the door. Props to them. But the idea is that they will probably sell that tear it down, and then make $300 million selling that real estate to somebody else. Okay, I guess they should do that. It's seen as a model of inefficiency. It's this giant, airy building, and it's like a circular space-age mall inside where you look up, and it goes all the way up to a dome on the top. And I got to say this, because I've been there a few times, you have too, and on the outside, that orange and blue, odd-shaped building is just bad-looking. But inside, it's pretty cool. It's the atrium that they have there. It's a lot of space to heat and cool, but it looks spectacular. You sit there and go, wow, this is amazing. It was also in a Halloween store, one of these pop-up Halloween shops recently, and I was amazed at how much Halloween merchandise there is now. Have you noticed this too? Have you spent or have your neighbors spent a lot of money on Halloween stuff lately? It's amazing to me.
We were decorating at our house, and I'm like, what's this about? The kids are gone. You know, what are we doing?
Brenda and I did that this morning. We're putting up ghosts in the backyard or on our deck and stuff.
And no one will see that but you and your kids. And
I know. So I said, well, now we got to have some people over because it's just you, me, and Daisy. So we're having the kids over tonight, and maybe if you know me, you'll probably be hearing from me. And if you do come on my deck, I want you to go, wow, that's really amazing. Or wherever
spooky.
Else. In our house. But here's the thing, though. So the stuff that we've cobbled together over the years and by now is whatever. I was in this store, and now the scary stuff is bloody. And it's animated. And it's pretty cool. But you need $247 to buy the thing I was looking at. I'm not making that number up. I walked into the store, and they had a doghouse there. It's like a big actual-size doghouse that your pit bull could be in. And it looks like a doghouse. And then it has a little, door cut into the front, and then there's a black curtain there.
Ooh.
And then there's a little mat that says something like welcome in front of that. And the idea would be that you'll step on that on purpose or accidentally. So I'm like, okay, I know something's going to happen, but I don't know what it is. So I'm stepping on it, and it doesn't work. And I'm stepping on it, and then I kind of forget that I'm stepping on it. And all of a sudden, roar! Charging out of the doghouse is this bloodthirsty hound with red eyes. It worked on me. It worked. So then I did it again, and frankly, I jumped again. I'm too easy. They had another one that was sort of like a scarecrow made of potato sacks. It's kind of that brown burlap.
Gunny sacks?
Yeah, and the head is dropped down like it's no longer living. And then you just step on the mat. This one might have been motion detected. But anyway, you walk by and the head pops up. And whoa, it makes a sound.
And see, the key is if it's on the mat, you put the mat, bury the mat under fallen leaves.
Sure.
So people don't know they're stepping on the mat.
Or put it on the other side of the candy dish, and it doesn't look that scary. It's like, all right, you got a scarecrow. Holy cow, did I jump out that thing. And I'm like, I'm at a store that's selling this. I'm standing on the mat that says, if you stand on this, it's going to go raw. And it still worked on me.
One of my favorite memories of being a parent, and I'm still a parent, but Noah loved Halloween. He just loved Halloween as a little kid. But he had such a vivid imagination that it also scared him to death.
Yeah.
So one time we saw him at Target, and he's standing at the edge of the Halloween aisle, just mesmerized by everything down the aisle, but he wouldn't take a step in it because he was scared to death.
My son was that way too, Steve. The Target aisle. He would not go down. He wouldn't go into the Target store with Brenda during Halloween.
But Noah would just stand there and stare at it, like in awe, but he wouldn't get a step closer.
Pretty cool, but I'm not going there.
Not
going
to do it.
And that was the thing. So Brenda and I are in this store that, has everything from naughty costumes, and not much of that, to just really scary costumes, and then bones and axes and skulls and all kinds of animated stuff. And then there's some princess costumes, too, for the kids. And there's kids wandering around with their parents, but the thing had kind of an almost PG-13 R-rated vibe. You know what I mean? It almost felt
That's what Halloween is now, unfortunately.
Inappropriate to have children in a Halloween store. was a bit much for me, I'll say that. One of the things, too, that was pretty clever, I forget what the war moment was. It might have been with that gunny sack creature, but it's holding the dish of candy. And so you reach in to get it, and when you reach in, you break the voice or the motion detector plane. It's the reaching into the bowl is what sets it off. So you reach in for the candy, and then pow, this thing comes at you for $200. And we were close. We were like, then you say, well, where are we going to put it? Do we need it? Is it that much fun? Will it work? You know, is this thing going to break after one episode? So yeah, we took a pass on it. But that's just where Halloween is. And I'm wondering where it is for you. How far are you going? How far have your family, friends, neighbors gone? Are you embracing this or have we crossed a line? And why don't you text me right now or call 312-981-7200 WGN. 312-981-7200 WGN. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. 233 WGN.
Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll. But listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control.
After the news at 2:30, we always ask producer Ellen to play a song for us and then tell us why. Ashley's filling in for Ellen today. What are you doing, Ash?
So we are playing the Rocky Horror Picture Show. We are actually playing Time Warp from it. It is the 1975 cult classic that comes to life every October. And I'm playing it because Hollywood Boulevard Cinema off of 75th and Woodridge, they have a showing this Saturday, actually, at 11:55. They usually do a bunch, but they're limiting their efforts this year. So this is one that they're having. They're having one again closer to Halloween. But if you miss this one, the Music Box Theater is also having them on Friday, October 25th and 26th. Again, then again on Wednesday, 30th, and Thursday, the 31st. So you have plenty of options to go see this cult classic, and you have to see it in the theater. It is, there's nothing like it.
Yeah, with the group participation and all, it's one I have not done. I'm kind of, I think, negligent in not getting that box punched yet.
You've never gone?
I'm a bad American. I haven't done it yet. It's 2:34. Speaking of Halloween and all things spooky like that, we were just talking about the way we decorate, celebrate, and spend on it these days. Hey, Jane, what did you want to say? You're on WGN. Hi, Jane, you're on the air. Jane, you will be. We'll come back to you. Let's try Gwen. Hi, Gwen.
John?
You're on. Yes, ma'am.
John?
Yes?
The name is not Jane, but I'll take the time anyway.
Go ahead.
I have a pet peeve, and I wonder if I'm the only one who has it. The upcoming holiday is spelled H-A-L-L, correct? O-W-W-E-N?
Yep.
But it is certainly these days pronounced as if it were H-O-L-L-O-W, Halloween, you hear, instead of Halloween, which is how it was always pronounced, and that's how it's spelled.
You're right. I get that one wrong every time I say Halloween. Instead, I should say
most
Halloween.
People do now, but why? Where did that come from?
I don't know. I didn't go to the meeting, but you're right. Everybody now says Halloween instead of Halloween. It's all Hallows Eve, and we should say Halloween. All right. All right. Have you fixed this one radio show? From now on, I will be a champion of the A.
Bless you.
Bless you. Thank you, Gwen. From you to Don, you're on WGN. Hi, Don.
Hello, John.
Hi, what's up, Donnie?
John?
Yes, sir.
Yes. As a youngster in my teens, we used to take an old Lionel train transformer and hook it up to the wrought iron railings going into our front door. So when the children would walk up, they would touch the wrought iron rail and get a bit of a shock. And we could turn that up or down depending on if we liked the kids.
And you did not. You shocked, did not do this.
Yes, I did.
Keep going.
Yes, after they got shocked, we had two trees, one to the left of our sidewalk and one to the right. And we had a rope with a pulley on it with a ghost, large ghost, like a 10-foot ghost hanging from it. And we would let loose of that ghost, and it would go across the sidewalk when they were running away from the electrified
railing. Nice. Nice. But Let's go back to the part where you were shocking children. So the kids would come up, you have this little electrical railing, and then you hook up a current to that, and you can control it with the thing like maybe my old train's transformer, a little more juice, a little less juice. Am I right about that generally?
That's exactly what it was, an old Lionel train transformer.
And did any parents or children complain about you electrocuting the kids in the neighborhood?
No, they didn't. Because it was so slight, they just thought it was funny.
So it just kind of like buzzed them. It just kind of itched them. It didn't really throw them into cardiac arrest.
No, that's correct. Yeah, if they had a pacemaker on, they would have been fine.
Don, you don't still do that, do you, Don?
No, I'm a little too old now to be playing around like that.
Well... God, oh for simpler times, right? But if
yes.
if you get
well,
a
it beats a $200 to $300 scary scarecrow like you're speaking.
Right,
of.
I know. Here, you were kind of a DIY in it, which is a beautiful thing. But if you get a hankering to do that again, I'm just going to remind you that in this day and age, you'll get in a lot of trouble if you do that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That's
Thank
fun.
You, John.
Thank you for the phone call. Honey, what are you doing there with the train transformer and you've put a rail up against the thing there? What are you doing? Well, let's talk to James. You're on WGN. Hi, James.
Hey, good afternoon, King John. How are you today?
I'm good. Talk to me. What do you want to say?
Oh, well, I'm one of those. I probably got 15 to 20 motion-activated Halloween creatures from a 6-foot Frankenstein to a walking Chucky. And I work at a cemetery, been doing it for 34 years, so it's kind of in my blood, and I love to scare the kids. Not too bad, but I you know, it's something in my blood. My kids actually, my daughter doesn't like Halloween no more because of me, but my boys enjoyed it.
How old are the boys and your daughter?
Well, now they're adults. I'm in my mid-50s, but now we have a 6-year-old that we've got custody of, and she is my little, she's my little sidekick. I mean, we have a blast.
And she enjoys all of this.
Oh, yes. Yes, she does. I mean, it's, you know, she pushes me every time we go to one of those Halloween stores. Dad, we need this. Dad, we need this. And yeah, we have a blast. And like I said, I've been doing this. I've been at the cemetery world for 34 years, and it's kind of in my blood.
Wait a minute. Do you work at a cemetery or a place called Cemetery World?
Nope. I work at a cemetery.
What do you do there?
I'm actually the superintendent. I've started from cutting the grass to digging the graves.
And when you put your stuff out, do you have a house like
Yes.
And then
yes,
people
I have
come
a
up.
House, and we decorate. I decorate the inside. I have a nice picture window, and then we do the outside if it's not raining. And I set little traps because I have some of those mats that were talked about
right,
where
I just
jump out. But I, like I said, I love it. My wife doesn't like it because I spend a small fortune. But to me, it's just great. It's the fall. It's and to watch the little kids and the young adults come to the house and get a little scare out of
is
a great thing.
What is your favorite gadget or scary thing you have out there this year, James?
You know what? It's an old favorite of mine, but it's a Frankenstein Boris Karloff, and it's motion activated, and it also talks. And I paid a fortune for that, but I love that thing.
What does he say when I come up to it?
He'll say, don't grab the candy or he'll start, buzzing. His eyes light up and it just, you know, then there's a lot of growling like, and I love it.
Have a great Halloween, James.
Yes, you too, John.
Thanks for the call. Diane, you're on WGN. How are you, Diane?
I'm good, John. Now, I heard from some type of market analyst. I either heard it or read it, and if I heard it, it was probably WGN a couple years ago. But the reason that the reason we are so crazy about Halloween is it was because our generation, the baby boomers,
yeah,
we were the ones that first started getting crazy with Halloween, and now we can't get in.
Right.
So
yeah.
We got our kids into it, now they've got the grandkids into it, but... It really blossomed in the 60s and the 70s, going all out, you know, the costumes with
those masks
that we can breathe out of.
That makes sense to me, because my parents weren't nuts for it. Nobody's parents were nuts for it, but we are for our kids.
Right, and they said, like I said, it was a business analyst was talking, and I was reading it.
Yeah, yeah.
It blew up, and that's when it blew up, because we are so into it, we don't want to let it go. We still want to dress up.
Thanks for the phone call. I'm glad you're listening, Diane.
Okay, bye.
Yeah, I think that she may be onto something. We did the same thing with Christmas, of course, and we're doing it with Halloween, too. And I can think of instances where I'm more enthusiastic about things that I was maybe enthusiastic about as a child. My kids are like, okay, you can turn it down. I wonder how many of the kids are like, Mom, Dad, you're overboard on this Halloween thing. That is something I never would have thought to say to my parents, because my parents never went overboard on anything like that, right? They said, all right, put a sheet over your head, you'll be a ghost. Get a bag out of the closet. That's your Halloween bag. Now walk around the neighborhood and go get some candy. That was Halloween, and it was great. That was all I needed. That was wonderful Halloween. But now we're spending hundreds of dollars on the thing. Alex, you're on the air. What did you want to say?
Hey, John. Good to be on the air.
Thank you, sir. What's on your mind?
I didn't have a glamorous, Halloween growing up. But we had this thing in our neighborhood, all the kids, we would egg and we would TP the houses that had really, crappy trick-or-treat offerings or whatever. Instead of candy, some people, there was a dentist that lived in our neighborhood that would hand out toothpaste and toothbrushes, so we would always egg his house.
Yeah, that ain't going to fly.
So that's how the kids knew, like, hey, if there's egg all over the guy's house or if there's TP, we know, stay away from that house.
Wow.
And I was a ghost every year for the last 10 years growing up. So I never had a flashy, cool costume. I could never be Chucky or,
right.
I was a ghost.
Yeah. Yeah, it worked, though. You still got candy, right?
I did. Yeah. And I ate all of it and then probably wound up with diabetes later on.
Alex, thanks for calling. And finally, Sue, you're on WGN. Hi, Sue.
Hi, John. Great to hear. Thank you. Growing up in my neighborhood, we had a very wealthy family that had a large estate. That being said, for many, many years, they would set up a whole Captain Jack Sparrow and the Pirates of the Caribbean set up for years and years. Wow. And years. And I know you're short on time, but they would take them a couple of months to set up, and they had the smoke machine and the music going, and the husband played the Jack Sparrow, and they handed out all the big candy bars, and it was a really neat way to give back to the community. It was a lot of fun.
I love the sound of that. That sounds wow.
They had a three-story home. They even had the mast on top of the house with the pirate ship and everything.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Wow. Oh, and of course the big candy bars, right?
That's it. You got to have that.
That word spreads around the neighborhood like nothing. If you start handing out the big candy bars, that word will be out, and the next thing you know, you've got a line at your door, which is really...
That's right. It was quite a spectacle.
Yeah. That's great. Thanks for the phone call.
Okay, thanks.
It's interesting, though, but right, because a kid can get a candy bar these days. Here again, back in my day, they didn't have big candy bars, and you didn't get many of them. It doesn't seem to me like that's out of most kids' price range these days. And yet... If you say you go to that house, they'll give you a big candy bar. It's maybe not the candy bar. It's the score. It's the thrill of going to the house with the good one. Anyway, it's 2:45. John Weideman will do play-by-play of Blackhawks hockey. Game 2 of the season, the home opener, is tonight at the UC. Just talked to Weideman off the air a minute ago. He said, hey, let me jump on with you. Or I said, will you jump on with me? And he said, yes, I would. So I've got a couple basic questions for John, like just for those of us that are getting into the season now, what are our chances? What are the keys to the season? Whose names do I need to hear him screaming out? Whose names do I need to start to learn this year? Just sort of give me the 411 on the Blackhawks season, Mr. Weideman. Neck. John Weideman, where are you? Earth to John Weideman. Ashley's going to get him here in just a second. Remember now, website for tickets, if you want to get them to see our Thomas Jefferson. It's the Teddy Roosevelt Show. I know why I do it. The same guy does them both. But the TR Show is the one that I think is the funniest and in many ways the most fun. I have been, could you tell, reading up a little bit on Teddy Roosevelt the last couple of weeks, just kind of seeing if there's some anecdotes that I might press him about or some stories that I should know about. I ask the questions. He has the answers. And he doesn't know always In fact, he didn't know at all what we're going to talk about. I did tip his hand the other day. I said, I'm going to ask you when we start to tell us the story about how you survived your assassination. And if an assassination attempt can be hilarious, his is. His is. But then you get to ask questions, too. So if there's something going on in the news, if there's something that you wonder what, it's not what one of our founding fathers would say, but the guy's up on Mount Rushmore for a reason. What would his take be on this? You know, people kind of do that when we have Jefferson on the stage. With Roosevelt, though, it's more tell us the story of. Tell us the story of San Juan Hill. Tell us the story of you being a cowboy. Tell us the story of your daughter, Alice. Tell us the story of stuff like that. Here's how you get your tickets. Go to WGNradio.com/Teddy. WGNradio.com/Teddy. You get your tickets there. There are, last I looked, the back row on the main floor was still available. And then I think the back two rows and the balcony were available. There's less than about 80 seats left, but you can get in. And I promise you, you will be thankful. You will get hooked on our Teddy Roosevelt. WGNradio.com/Teddy. All right. Is that Mr. W on the phone? John Weideman, the play-by-play voice of the Blackhawks on WGN Radio. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm well, John. How you doing?
You sound great. You did the other night, or day, or whatever that was for you and for us. But how weird or how fun or how hard was it to do the hockey game overseas?
You know what, John? It was all of those things. It really was. It was weird because we weren't in North America. And I'll go to the hard part first. It was hard because I did not know the broadcast position. I didn't know a lot of the people that I would have been working with. I didn't know what to expect as far as acoustics were concerned. But Troy and I worked through it because, you know, when you're a professional, you deal with those things. And I can tell you this, for every tough broadcasting position I might encounter in the NHL, I've encountered at least 10 of them in the minors. So that just wasn't a factor.
Yeah.
And then it was immensely fun, John. It really was. It was one of the greatest experiences of my life. I would wholeheartedly recommend the cities of Berlin and especially Prague in the Czech Republic to anybody that wants to travel and take in a city or cities that have great history, great tradition, and in the case of Prague in the Czech Republic, a culture and kind of an old-time feel to that city that it hasn't been touched in a century. And some of the buildings in Prague date back to, like, the 12th and 13th century. They've been preserved. And so it, for me, somebody that really appreciates architecture, I appreciate old cathedrals, I appreciate buildings that have been, you know, preserved over the centuries. I mean, it really was an enriching kind of an experience.
Yeah, everybody I heard from that was over there sure had a great time. And the Blackhawks didn't win that game, but as it turns out, it's not the only game of the season. Game two now, our home openers tonight. Right. Just give me your overview. Like, how good are the Blackhawks going to be? What needs to happen this year?
Okay, good question, and I'm going to get right to it. Number one, they've got to cut their goals against down. They finished second from the bottom in the National Hockey League, only to the Ottawa Senators, or most goals allowed. And I think Stan Bowman and the hockey ops guys addressed that in the offseason, acquiring a couple of defensemen whose games as defensemen are not inclined toward offense, but more than anything, they're inclined toward defense. And I think you need that element on your blue line. So he did that. Number two, he got himself a backup goaltender that could be a starting goaltender by bringing in Robin Lehner. Robin Lehner and Corey Crawford are going to be a nice 1-2 punch. I mean, health permitting, they're going to be a nice 1-2 punch in net for the Blackhawks. And then Stan went out, and he, in my opinion, he addressed the depth issue on the roster. So the bottom six forwards last year that, unfortunately, and they're all great guys, but together as they played for the Blackhawks, there were little picadillos that surfaced, and it caused the team to lose games. And I didn't mention the penalty kill. I think that's a huge focus for this team going into this season. That has got to improve. It's got to go from last in the league, which was 31st last year, to, if they could just get to average, John, if they could get to the 15th or the 16th position this year, with that kind of an improvement, I think that could help them to the point, all of that combined could help them to the point where we're talking about a team that's going to make the playoffs.
It's funny when you think about the Blackhawks, at least I do, I think about our goal scorers and how much fun it is to watch them on that end of the ice, but at least two of those things are very much about the other end of the ice, three of them, really.
Yeah, that's true. You got to play a 200-foot game in the NHL now with the way that teams can skate with the young talent that's available in the league. And, man, it's an awful lot of fun to talk about these kids coming into the league at young ages and having a real effect on the way the league turns out or season turns out.
Yeah.
If you're not playing a 200-foot game, you may not be playing in the NHL. It's
so
gotten to that point.
What's the score then of a prototypical Blackhawks game? If all of these pieces come into place, then they're going to have fewer goals than us, and maybe the overall score is going to be a little less. What would be the score of a Blackhawks game for you, ideally, then?
I think a typical game this season, and I think you can kind of expect this, if all things remain the same, and I always say, health permitting,
yep.
Because if people get injured, we start experiencing a rash of injuries to key players, it's going to change everything. But health permitting, I think that the kind of a score that the Blackhawks are looking at here that they want to see is them coming out on top, of course, but the score being like 4-2 with an empty net goal. They lost a number of one-goal games last year. They actually won a number of one-goal games last year as well. A lot of that was due to their play in overtime and in shootout. But they've got to win games in regulation and not allow that extra point to the opposition, particularly Western Conference opposition, because down the road toward the playoffs, those numbers end up factoring into what could be the Blackhawks' demise. So if they can close an opponent out in regulation, no mean feat, but if they can keep the opponent to two goals or fewer, I think they got a real good chance of getting back into the playoffs this year.
What player are you most interested in watching? Well, who's going to be the most fun to watch this year?
For me, it's going to be Dominik Kubalík. He wears the number 8. He is from the Czech Republic. I got a glimpse of him over in Prague. He's on a line now with left to right, Brandon Saad on the left wing. David Kampf, his countryman from the Czech Republic, is centering that line. And Dominik Kubalík plays on the right wing. He's a kid that has a great amount of speed. He's got a really quick shot, a real quick release of the puck. Like he'll put a stick in a position so as to accept the pass. And as soon as the puck hits his stick in the very next quick motion, it's at the net. And he's going to score. I believe he's going to score a lot of goals that way. So he, to me, is an exciting player. I'll also tell listeners that might be curious about this. Well, what's he like? Who does he remind you of? He reminds me, personally, of a guy that used to play for the Minnesota Wild, Marian Gaborik, who was a tremendous player. So I think if Dominik Kubalík can, develop into that kind of a player for the Blackhawks, they're really going to have something.
I'm looking forward to your call of the game. You're fun to listen to, my friend, not just because it's Blackhawks hockey, but because you are a master at it. So we'll tune you in this evening, John Weideman.
You got it, John. I appreciate the accolades and appreciate you having me on. Be well.
Best to the family, best to the team, tonight on WGN.